Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, June 12th, 2017, and I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. We have a busy agenda this morning.
Chatter down on that side of the table.
It's been a long weekend. We haven't seen each other in days. It's rough.
We're glad to have everybody back together. It's all good. I am going
to
start by opening a work session on House Bill 5003, Commission for the Blind. Ms. Tao, get us started here, please.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. So the first item on the agenda today is House Bill 5003, which is the appropriation bill for the Oregon Commission for the Blind. So for the 2017-19 biennium, LFO recommend budget for the Oregon Commission for the Blind is 68 positions, 62.53 FTE, and $21,485,304 total funds. The budget reflects an increase in federal funds and other funds, but a decrease in general fund. The attached recommendations from the LFO office for the Oregon Commission contains the following. And first, like all the budgets, all the statewide adjustments are not in this bill. It'll be included in the omnibus bill at the end of the session. The first package is Policy Option Package 101. This package includes an increase in federal revenues, reflecting an update in the Memorandum of Understanding between the Department of Human Services and the Commission for the Blind. This agreement adjusts the percentage of the federal vocational rehabilitation grant award for the Commission for the Blind from 12.5% to 15.6% to align Oregon with the national average ratio and to comply with the new requirements of the Workforce Investment and Opportunities Act. With this, $2,536,574 increase in federal revenue, the agency will invest in its vocational rehabilitation program by leveraging federal funding to increase the number of third-party cooperative agreements with educational institutions and by building its capacity to offer technology training, job site assessment, and workplace accommodations. To build this capacity to meet the requirements, the agency would reorganize and establish new counselors and instructor positions. The package you'll see will be a reduction in general fund of $350,000. Plus a $331,970 other funds increase and a $2.5 million federal funds increase, 10 positions and 12.39 FTE. The second package is package policy option 102. In accordance with the state's chief human resource office classification guidelines, this is a funding neutral package. It shifts fund from special payments to personal services and related services and supplies to reclassify two positions that serve as the summer work experience program from temporary consultants to seasonal staff. Like I said, it's a zero to fund package, but it does add two positions and two FTE. The third package is package 103. It's a case management system migration package for the agency. The commission requested $639,788 in general fund and one limited duration position and half an FTE to migrate its automated case management system to a vendor. This is necessary because the vendor that they're currently using is going out of business. But what LFO is recommending is that to relieve some of the constraints in the general fund, that the agency use existing staff for project management and delay the implementation of the package 101 we mentioned earlier, and not hire some of the instructor positions and use that funding to fund the migration to the new vendor. And this package, they'll only use $156,291 general fund and then $394,390 federal fund and with no new positions. And the companion package to this 103 would be policy package 802, which means we adjust package 101 to reduce it by the same amount in general fund, federal fund to support the package. And then the last package for the agency would be policy package 801. This package shifts fund match for two positions to reduce constraints on the general fund. And also just it makes more business sense because the two positions, one is a vocational rehabilitation counselor and the other is a business enterprise program analyst. And instead of using general fund to match federal fund, we're going to use donations and the business enterprise set aside to fund these two positions. So we'll reduce the agency budget by $134,158 general fund and increase it by $134,158 other funds. And those are the changes to the agency's budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5003.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5003. Discussion? Senator Whitaker?
Yeah, I just have a question. And given the shift from general fund to a lot from general fund to federal funds, and I see the addition of 10 positions, and looking at the future and the uncertainty of D.C., are these permanent or are they temporary?
Senator Winters, members of the committee, yes, these are permanent, and it is a permanent fund shift and federal fund, as permanent as federal fund can be.
That's why I asked if they were permanent or if they're
limited duration.
But they are not limited duration. They are an we do anticipate this $2.5 million to be part of the agency's budget.
So you anticipate when the federal funds are no longer there that the general funds will absorb it?
No. We anticipate that the general fund will continue into the future. Because this
the federal fund
will continue into the future because this is an agreement with DHS. The state gets a certain portion of this federal fund each year, and this is just an increase from 12.5% to 15%. Because this is to bring the state up with all the rest of the states.
Just for the record, there's never any certainty for federal funds, and I need to put that on the record in case anybody is listening out there in Never Never Land. And so, you know, based on administrative changes back in Washington or congressional action, there is no permanency. So just need to put that on the record. Thank you.
We will be facing a lot of changes if there are substantial changes in the federal funds, and this will not be the only one.
Yeah.
So, any further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? If not, so moved.
Okay, so we'll move on to key performance measures. We're going to recommend that most of the targets remain as presented, but LFO does recommend two changes. For key performance measure number one, LFO recommends changing this key performance to percentage of vocational rehabilitation participants who are employed in unsubsidized competitive integrated settings the second quarter after exiting the program. Basically, this change is just to make our state language match exactly the federal language so that we can do across the state comparison. And that's really the only change. And for key performance number two, LFO recommends changing this key performance to percentage of eligible individuals closed successfully and unsuccessfully in the older blind independent living program who reported feeling that they are in greater control or are more confident in their ability to maintain their current living situation as a result of services received. Again, with this change, we're just changing the state language to match the federal language. And also the commission will still be capturing the number of eligible individuals who reported feeling that they're in greater control and are more confident in their ability to maintain their current living situation, but within the federal fiscal year.
Okay. All right. Good.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation on key performance measures. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
Okay, and then our final thing is there's an amendment just to change the funding amounts in the bill to match the LFO recommendation.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 5003.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 5003. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 5003 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves House Bill 5003 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved. Representative Rayfield, will you take this to full?
Yes.
Senator Gelsinger, will you take this to the Senate floor, please? Thank you. Volunteer from the House to take this to the House floor. Representative Malmstrom, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Closing the work session on House Bill 5003 and opening a work session on House Bill 5021, Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Welcome, Ms. Byerly. Good morning. Happy Monday.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. So out in Olas for you today is another packet, the LFO recommendations on House Bill 5021, which is the budget bill for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. There's also a separate document that has the agency's key performance measures. So in the memo, there's a table that shows what the recommendation is. So the total funds recommendation for this agency is $7,256,967, 25 positions, and 24.50 full-time equivalent positions. This budget is a decrease from the current service level, but it's slightly over the 2015-17 legislatively approved budget. The recommendations include the following. There's a policy package that adds $117,040 other funds expenditure limitation to allow the Residential Facilities Ombudsman Program to spend civil penalty revenues. These are revenues that come through Department of Human Services as they investigate facilities and capture some civil penalties in certain situations. There's also a package that reduces the Oregon Public Guardian Conservator Program by $600,000 general fund. There's also a budget note associated with this package that I will read into the record. And there's also a $200,000 special purpose appropriation to the emergency board that's related to this action. When the program presented during their Ways and Means hearings, I think there was a lot of discussion and some concern about kind of where the program was headed. So this is to design an opportunity for the to take a second look at the program, for Fred to work with his staff and stakeholders, and come back and visit with you during session about kind of next steps for the program. They're also going to work to implement some third-party contracts to help with some of the guardianship program issues. So attached to the memo is the LFO work session papers, where I've highlighted both of those packages. On page 3 of 5 of that LFO work session report is the description of the package 101, which is for that quality care fund revenues being pulled into the budget. And on page 5 of 5 is the reduction package for the Office of the Public Guardian. Okay, so the first adjustment would be to go ahead and adopt the LFO recommendations to the budget.
So, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5021.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5021. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved.
Then on the key performance measurements recommendation on that second document in OLIS, or if you have a hard copy of the printout, it's in the last page of the packet. Basically, the recommendation is to maintain the KPMs as proposed and approve the targets as shown in the record. For the KPMs number 7 and 8, we'd like to have the agency look a little bit deeper into the data and see if they can find a little bit more precision or meaningful metric to help identify some of the trends in those areas. Right now, the measures are pretty broad, and it's a little fuzzy on exactly what the agency does to kind of impact those measurements. We'd like to have them do a little bit more looking into that. And then secondarily, in conjunction with the assessment of the Public Guardian program that I'm going to talk about in context of the budget note, we'd like to identify at least 2 proposed key performance measures related to that program. And that's information that we come back and report on. So those will be measures for the next biennium, not the current biennium.
So Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendations on key performance measures. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved.
And the next item in your memo is the budget note I've mentioned a couple times, so I'll go ahead and read that. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman is directed to thoroughly assess the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator Program. The assessment should evaluate the following: required versus discretionary services, service delivery alternatives and their costs, caseload characteristics, priorities and scalability, cost per case differences between public and private guardianship work, opportunities to leverage volunteer and pro bono resources to help support the program, metrics for measuring program success and effectiveness, and ways to ensure the fiscal account sustainability of the program with limited resources. A written report on the assessment must be completed and submitted to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means prior to the beginning of the 2018 legislative session. The report will be used by the legislature to help determine next steps, set funding priorities, and develop key performance measures for the program. And again, there will be that money set aside in a special purpose appropriation to possibly tap as part of those next steps.
Great.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on budget notes.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation on budget notes. Is there discussion?
no discussion, but a comment. I'm really pleased to see this budget note, because we did have a lot of discussion about the Guardianship Conservancy program and the direction it's headed in and what services that it could or would and could provide. So it's very supportive.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved.
So, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the budget adjustments for this budget are captured in the amendment to House Bill 5021 that's in OLIS. You'll see the changes to the actual budget as well as additional language that sets up that special purpose appropriation.
Hi, Madam Chair, move adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5021.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Rayfield moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5021. Discussion.
Can you just tell me the process that is followed to insert a budget note into these?
Sure. Budget notes can be suggested by anybody. If there's a concern that they have about an agency that wants to be done, generally what happens is that if you're interested in having a budget note done, you start by talking to the co-chairs of the subcommittee that's involved. All budget notes have to be approved by the big co-chairs, by Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson. They're usually start with a general outline by whoever's recommending them, and then LFO staff work to refine them into sort of standard, a little more standard language, and then they get approved by both the subcommittee chairs and the big co-chairs and go into the budget. But anybody can suggest a budget note.
Anybody defined as?
Any legislator, or realistically, any member of the public can work with a legislator to suggest a budget note, and then the legislator brings it forward.
But it has to come through a legislator.
It has to come through a legislator. Yeah. I mean, we don't have members of the public go to LFO and say, I want this budget note, generally speaking.
Can LFO initiate it without direction from a representative or senator?
I suppose in theory, but I've never, Ms. Byer.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, from a personal perspective, some analysts are not fans of lots of budget notes. So I think what will happen at times, if there is a particular issue we know and members are trying to work with on a budget, we may suggest something around a budget note. But as far as formally bringing forward language, most of our participation is working with a member to figure out how to solve a problem or try to identify an issue we want to follow up on.
Does that help answer your question, Representative?
Thank you.
Great. Any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the measure? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 5021 as amended to the full committee with a DPS recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves House Bill 5021 as amended to the full committee with a DPS recommendation. Discussion. Opposition.
Good.
If not, so moved. Senator Winters, would you be kind enough to take this to full onto the Senate floor? Thank you. Volunteer from the House, Representative Alonso Leon.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Okay. Good. I am closing the work session on House Bill 5021 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 243 relating to abuse reporting regarding children in care. Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I believe Erica is going to go check to see if there's anybody signed in to testify. But I think you may have a member on the committee who's interested in testifying. For context, let me provide a little bit of background on the bill. So this is a bill that came to you from the Senate Human Services Subcommittee. It's a bill that deals with child welfare and the definition of the definition of child care, to expand that to include certain services that aren't clearly included in that definition within the Department of Human Services. The bill had a public hearing back on the 1st of February, and it had a work session on February 13th in that Human Services Committee before it came to Ways and Means.
Great. Yeah, please.
I think I have that.
While the senator's coming up, there's also four pieces of written testimony I believe the senator's going to refer to, as well as there was one other additional piece of written testimony that was submitted to the committee for this meeting. And they're all labeled Senate Bill 243.
Senator.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, and the surrounding areas, and also the chair of the Senate Human Services Committee. And I am very grateful to you for scheduling a public hearing on Senate Bill 243 and hope that we see the work session soon. So Senate Bill 243 comes to you unanimously from the Senate Policy Committee. This bill builds on work that we started to do in the fall of 2015 and moving into 2016 around the safety of children in care. As you may be aware, Oregon outpaces the nation, unfortunately, in terms of the rate of abuse of kids in care. Our rate of abuse of kids in care is far too high. And what you need to remember, when children go into foster care, when they go into substitute care, by definition, they are at risk and they are vulnerable, and we have a special obligation as the guardians of these children of the state of Oregon to ensure that they are safe. With Senate Bill 1515 in the 2015-2016 legislative session, it's funny, all the years start to move together, we adopted a definition of abuse for children in care. Because that bill was going into effect relatively quickly, it applied only to children in care through child caring agencies, licensed child caring agencies. So that included organizations like an Albertina Kerr or the Children's Farm Home, and then also foster parents that did not receive certification from a state DHS program, but from a Proctor Care agency. So on a day-to-day basis, it would look the same, but because they were kind of through this almost some subcontracted organization, this definition applied to them. At the time that we passed Senate Bill 1515, we talked about coming back and having a unified definition of abuse of kids in care to see if there were modifications that needed to be made and to allow time for training. So there are a couple of pieces of information that you have. I can see you all searching through the written information. Let me tell you what that is. These are all of the substantiated allegations of abuse under this definition in all of the settings to which that applies between October of 2016 and March, the end of March of 2017. And we'll be getting another report in July that will be the second quarter of this year. The reason that this is really important is that we've heard a lot of discussion about inappropriate substantiation of allegations of abuse in substitute care. So one of the things that we wanted to do with Senate Bill 1515 was to create some transparency around that and ask the agency to show us what is it that is being substantiated under these definitions. So one thing that I was concerned about, that I had heard a lot of concerns raised, was that people and organizations were getting substantiated allegations of abuse for things like giving 3 Tylenol instead of 2 Tylenol, and then this was messing up someone's license or messing up someone's future because they had the substantiated allegation of abuse. If you are to look through all of these, the actual data, that actually is not the case. Now, we did have a problem when Senate Bill 1515 went into effect in that it created a degree of confusion and concern. There was not a lot of time to do training, and so in July and August of last year, there was a significant spike in the number of calls that went into the hotline, the number of calls that OWAPI assigned for investigation. It did not change the number that were substantiated for abuse, and those numbers reversed pretty quickly. So, for example, in June of 2016, there were 51 calls that went into the hotline, 34 were assigned for investigation, and 17 were closed at screening. Then you get into the spike. In July, you had 91 calls that went in, 67 were assigned, and 23 were closed at screening. The biggest impact of this was in August, when there were 283 calls, 112 assigned, and 172. By the next month, however, OWAPI, under the leadership of their new director, really started to reverse the course, and the number of investigations dropped back again to number 15. These numbers are in OLIS from our presentation from Dr. Richardson. So the point behind all of this is we've tested this experience, we've tested this definition, it has worked, and one of the things that we learned is that we need more time for training. And that's why these definitions would not go into effect for the rest of the substitute care community until January 1st of 2018. which allows plenty of time for training in the field and within DHS. Another important thing about this idea of a unified definition of abuse for children in care is that it was a key recommendation from the public knowledge report that was commissioned by the governor to look at the issue of safety of kids in care, and it is also included in the Unified Child Safety Plan that the department has put together. Now, in terms of what the bill actually does, why is it different? Why would there be a different definition of abuse for children in care than children in home? The reason for that is that, and in my opinion, it's very unfortunate, in Oregon we provide a broad range of authorities to parents to discipline their children, including things like willful infliction of pain. You can spank a child with an object as long as you aren't leaving the wrong kinds of bruises or the wrong kinds of bruises in difficult kinds of places. You can chemically restrain your child. You can do all sorts of things. By the time a child is in care, that standard of abuse really needs to be different. We have kids that are traumatized, we have kids that need safety plans, and their discipline could really impact them significantly. So the difference in the definition for a child in care versus a child in my home that I am raising is that the additions are willful infliction of pain. So we are saying that as a foster parent, a substitute care provider of an abused or neglected child, you cannot willfully inflict pain on a child or willfully inflict an injury on a child. The second thing is that you cannot have sex with your foster child even if they agree to have sex with you, even if they are between the ages of 18 and 21, nor can anyone that is working for you in your foster home have sex with your foster child. That is an important element of Senate Bill 243, that you cannot tie up a foster child with ropes or straps. You cannot lock them in a closet or lock them in a room, and you cannot drug them without a prescription from a physician. Those are basically the additions of to this child in care definition that would be different from what's in 419B and applies to the children that we all raise. And again, that could be a conversation for another day. I would be alarmed if any of us were doing those things to our children at home. There is some written testimony that talks about who decides what's age appropriate. So we've got some definitions in here. I forgot the other one was financial exploitation. So if I'm raising a child, I'll have a commingling of funds with my minor children. But once you've taken a child into care, that child may have a bank account. As a foster parent or a child caring agency, you can't access that bank account for your own purposes. You can't confiscate a child's iPhone and give it to your child or your niece or your nephew as a gift. That is what that piece is. But around that and involuntary seclusion and some of the definitions around intimidation, there is a clause, and this was added since, and this will apply across the board to the child caring agencies as well, that involuntary seclusion, for instance, the statute would say does not include age-appropriate disciplinary activities such as a timeout. The chemical restraint does not include something that a physician has prescribed for the child, and that wrongful taking of assets does not include age-appropriate statements of, if you don't do your homework, you don't get screen time tonight, so you know your iPad is going into the box. That's not what this is about. This is about actually taking possession of something and taking ownership of that. I think it is, again, incredibly important that kids have these protections. It is unfortunate that we have such a high rate of abuse in care in the state of Oregon right now. This will help us have better training moving forward. These are very reasonable changes. And again, if you go and you look through the actual data of what has actually been substantiated since we changed the law for children in care, if you look at what these substantiated allegations are, they are stunning and shocking. They involve a lot of inappropriate sexual contact between staff or care providers and children. There are many things around. It's not a medication error.
Senator Geltzer,
yes.
Can you differentiate for me, the rates in the residential facilities, group homes, and what have you, and the other, because we've got several categories of foster care. And not having been in your committee and not knowing what those rates are in all those various categories, I struggle with putting everybody in the same universe. Because I know that we've got good, very good, excellent foster parents and foster homes and what have you, and then there are those that maybe are not so good. I know that there's been some serious situations in some of our residential care facilities and what have you. So I'm trying to wrap my head around, just really what's the target and what are you trying to get at?
Sure. Co-Chair Stainer Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Senator Winters, yes, we have a variety of different types of substitute care. Oregon's rate of abuse of children in care and substitute care is higher than the national average and higher than most states in every category, including in certified foster care. What this does is it ensures that whether a child is in care in a certified foster home or a child caring agency.
Now, I'm going to ask you another question.
Okay.
Because there's been complaints from the Foster Parents Association, the lack of actual training and involvement with the agency and foster parents and what have you. So was that taken into consideration when you were talking about this particular piece of legislation?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, yes, foster parents need vastly more training. They need more training around kids that have significant needs. They should be having safety plans for their kids. But at the same time, what is described in the statute in terms of the change here, you should not need training to know that you should not willfully inflict pain on a child. You should not need training to know that you should not have sex with your foster child. So that, I mean, the level of what we are talking about in this, it's a level of abuse that would have to be investigated. It would have to be determined that allegation was substantiated. But what is being added here should already be part of the training. There's nothing in here that you are currently allowed to do as a foster parent. Right now it would be
That's perhaps a licensing violation.
But if it's not against the law, then they can't necessarily say anything about it is the problem. And that's what Senator Gelcher is trying to clarify.
And Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, the other issue is that because our licensors are so overburdened, if it goes to a licensing violation, the necessity, and if you talk to the foster youth, if you read the public knowledge report, do not trust their certifiers. They do not trust the child welfare hotline. They do not trust that when they raise concerns of abuse or neglect that anyone is going to respond to them. This will kick these particular incidents into a level of somebody looking at it to see if it meets that statutory level of abuse, and hopefully someone can get in to intervene for these kids. And I'm concerned about foster parents. The vast majority of foster parents are fantastic.
You mentioned sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is a crime.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, it is, but we have children in care that are 18, 19, and 20 years old. It is not a crime to have sex with an 18, 19, or 20-year-old to whom you are not related. So these kids, where there are staff or there are foster parents or there are family members of the foster parents, there's a power dynamic there. It is never appropriate to have sex with your foster kid, even if they are of the age of the majority. This addresses that. Right now, there is absolutely no way to get at that behavior.
Just for the ones who are 18 and above. I mean, I don't think anybody disagrees that this should all be common sense, mm-hmm. and nobody should be thinking about it. But unfortunately, we all know that whether it's in a licensed facility or a traditional foster home, that we're going to run into problems sometimes, and it's important to clarify this. I do have one question. I'm assuming when you say have sex, you mean any sexual contact,
correct,
not just actual intercourse.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, yes, any sexual contact, any inviting people to your house to have sex with your foster children, which is something that has occurred as well, and we were not able to substantiate and respond to that.
So you're talking about the older.
We're talking about the older ones in that particular case. We're talking about any age for one of these other ones.
Good question.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Does this, like the work you're doing, thank you. Does this change the definition of statutory rape, or would this be tied to the facility's licensing only?
Co-Chair Stoner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Hayden, no, this does not change the definition of statutory rape. It's just, and this is not a criminal charge. This is an administrative finding, basically, within the Department of Human Services that relates to that particular relationship.
So it would affect their ability to have the license to do that?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, in the case of certified foster care, there's not a license, you have a certification, and what would happen is you'd have a substantiated allegation of abuse, which would mean that if you applied to, in the future, be a foster parent, that would come up in the weighing test that the criminal backgrounds check unit does. They look through your history of criminal convictions, and they also look through the history of substantiated allegations of abuse. They do not look at inconclusive. And then they do a weighing test to look at does this substantiated allegation, how does that impact the job or the task that this person is applying to do as a caregiver at this time? My guess is that a substantiated allegation of sexual abuse would probably be more likely to disqualify a person from providing further care than a substantiated allegation for neglect or a medication error.
Senator Winters.
I'm going back now to just the certification issue. And if there's, you know, willful pain, which can lend itself to assault and trauma, and why those don't rise to a much higher level. If you've got a foster parent situation or a residential facility situation where they're doing that kind of abuse, why would we want to continue to have them either certified? Why aren't they charged?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, there's a couple of reasons. One is that the certifier might not ever find out about it. A mandatory reporter calls the child welfare hotline. If willful infliction of pain, they go and they look at 419B, that is not considered child abuse under 419B. So that could be closed at screening. That could be the end of the story, and the certifier is never notified that that occurs. One of the other things that Senate Bill 243 does is ensure that those notifications happen within the agency. So if there are concerns that are being raised about the safety of a child in foster care, and it doesn't rise to the level of abuse, the right person is going to be informed so that they can go in and provide assistance or technical support before that rises to the level of abuse. Or if there is a concern that is there, it provides somebody to talk with the child. The other thing that the bill does is it will allow us to have reports like the one that you have in front of us that will give us actual data so that we can know, is the department appropriately substantiating allegations of abuse, or are they kind of wantonly saying you're substantiated and you're substantiated? We will be able to see how this actually plays out in terms of investigations and what these issues are. Right now, we have a number that tells us this is the percentage of kids that experience abuse in care. We don't have a way of knowing what that abuse is, if that is sexual abuse or if that's a medication error. We now know that for child caring agencies. This will allow us to know that for foster care as well. And that will help us as we're looking at things like definitions of abuse, what we need to do in terms of training. I know one of the conversations that I've had with the Alliance about both the substantiated allegations of abuse and the calls that have gone into the kind of the concern, the notifications hotline, it's clear that there needs to be more training around appropriate boundaries with kids, given the number of allegations of romantic and sexual relationships, smoking cigarettes together, doing drugs together, drinking beer together. You've got young staff. That's an area that we could improve and prevent that from happening to kids by doing the training. We can see that now because that is all in the open and we're able to see what those challenges are.
How involved is the law enforcement agency with this particular subject?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, on occasion, it depends really a lot on the community. In terms of the child care agencies that we have seen so far, those investigations have been done by AWAPI, which is a service out of the central office. For certified foster care, those investigations are done out of the central office, and sometimes law enforcement and a child protective services worker will go out together. Sometimes sometimes one will go on their own. It oftentimes depends on the county, the training, and the case. But there are cross reports, like every child abuse report that goes into the child welfare hotline, there's a requirement that those be cross reported to law enforcement.
I guess for me, I'd like to somehow, someplace in the future, get beyond just reports and that there's some action. It seems to me if we have elevated and you know, we're saying that child abuse is out of the charts in Oregon, and you know, we're now into, you know, having more substantiation, something is terribly, terribly wrong in our system.
So Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Winters, our rate of abuse and care has not been increasing. We're just talking about it for the first time. If we'd been listening to our foster youth, they have been telling us about this problem for a long time. The response that we often give to them is, your behaviors are difficult, you're in care because you are a problem, and this job is really difficult for providers. It is true that this job is really difficult for providers, but once a child is in care and they are in the responsibility of the state, there is absolutely no excuse for child abuse or anything that looks like child abuse. These are kids that have been traumatized. If we talk about trauma-informed care at its very base,
I don't want to give the public the impression that all children that come into foster care, which is not true, because we have infants that come into foster care that are in a different setting, and I want to try to separate in my own brain of you know, just what population are you talking about when you say all kids, because it really, we have, the reason we have so many different graduations of foster parents and care is because we recognize in placement that, you know, you have to have a variety of placements to meet all the different needs of children. So I just need to put that out there because people listen to our conversation that we have. I commend you what you're doing, but I'm just trying to figure it all out.
And Co-Chair Senator Hayward, just to end, Senator Winters, just to clarify, yes, not every child that's come into care has been physically abused, but it is a trauma to be removed from your family. So every child, whether it's an infant or whoever, it's a time of crisis in their lives. And as the substitute parent, as the state of Oregon, I believe we have a very heightened responsibility for those children.
For me, as a parent, I think we all have a heightened responsibility.
I agree.
I'm gonna call time for a minute because I know Representative Bueller has a question, and I know we have another bill to hear. So, Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Gelser, we heard earlier this session about the ability for foster kids specifically to access the complaint system through an app or their smartphone. Have you had any experience, or how is that working, or is that a viable option for them to self-report problems?
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, that actually is an app primarily for foster parents. That is the 211 system.
May I follow?
Mm-hmm. Please.
So there's no way for foster kids themselves to report their concerns about possible abuse or their need for help through a easy, quick method.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, theoretically, if a child is having a face-to-face meeting with their caseworker every month, they should be able to tell them. Theoretically, if we were adequately staffing our child welfare offices, kids could get return calls from their caseworkers whenever they made a phone call, and kids can always call the child welfare hotline. What the kids have reported, and when we worked on the public knowledge, kind of this big external advisory group that we worked on for that, when the governor brought in this outside consultant and we listened to youth, it was pretty devastating to listen to them. And if you read the report, kids feel stuck and unheard when they raise these concerns, and frequently the response, instead of trying to figure out what's happening with this kid, is what's wrong with this kid. And I just hope we can take our child welfare system, address the issues that are there for adults, but really focus it back on these kids. And when kids raise a concern, we should listen to them. Are there ever false allegations? Sure, there is in anything. But when a child is making an allegation, we've got to figure out, why are they saying that? What's going on in their lives that's causing them to try to get attention in this way? And we have to believe kids most of the time.
I completely relate to false allegations. Mm-hmm. Do the kids have access to a cell phone themselves or a smartphone that foster kids, is it a policy for them to have one in any way?
co-chair Steiner Hayward, co-chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, a child might have a cell phone if they have a child a phone that belongs to them as they come into care and they're in an older child, but it is not a policy that the department has cell phones. In fact, one of the brand new developments for our hardworking caseworkers is that we just gave caseworkers texting capability just like last month.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Gelser, thank you for your hard work on this. I will just put on the record, I'm a little concerned about how high the fiscal is on this, and I want to be sure we can move this forward. So I'm going to put it out there to DHS and DOJ, who are contributing to the fiscal, that I'd like you to go back and look and see if you can pare this fiscal down a little bit, because this is really important work, and I wouldn't want to see this stuck because of a $450,000 fiscal. I think that would be very disappointing. Right, so I just want to put that out there that I'm going to ask both agencies to look at that pretty hard. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 243E and opening one on Senate Bill 512. Ms. Byerly.
So, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 512 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. There was a public hearing on this bill on the 10th of April and a work session on the 18th of April. This is a bill that extends, basically changes some of the language around parentage. My understanding is primarily to help the Division of Child Support to move forward on some support issues, and I believe we have some public testimony on the bill today.
Thank you, and we do. Let's start with the DOJ for folks, Kate Cooper Richardson and Vera Pop. I got your name, Poe? Pop? Sorry. Can't read. Sorry. Please.
Good morning, Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program at the Department of Justice, and our child support program introduced or requested the introduction of this bill to help us through specific area. You may not know, or you may, depending on how much you know about the Oregon Child Support Program and all child support programs, that a major part of what we do is establish paternity and parentage for children. You can't have a child support order until the child has two legal parents. And so that is a large part of what we do in establishing child support orders in the first place. We requested introduction of this bill because there is a marital presumption already in longstanding for a child born into a marriage that the father or the husband in that marriage is presumed to be the father if a child is born within the marriage. So this bill would extend the marital presumption to same-sex married couples as well. And it also then, by doing that, it means that spouse of the birth mother, then that income would be considered for public assistance purposes, and that the spouse could also be considered for a placement option for that child. There is some case law. I mean, obviously, same-sex marriage is legal, but there is some case law out there, some dicta that describes that presumption as a biological paternity issue, and so this legislation would overcome that. And there are also some pieces here with gender-neutral language and also defining some assisted reproduction. We see this as a very important bill for moving forward to smooth the establishment of parentage for children in our program. We have been dealing with same-sex parents of children for a long time, but in the establishment, having that marital presumption really does smooth and move forward the establishment of a child support order. It doesn't change any filiation proceedings, any voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. Those are based on biological paternity. It doesn't change that. It just adds this presumption for same-sex married couples. If you have technical, there's written testimony here from the Department of Justice. If you have other questions here, Vera Poe, who's our policy development manager, is also here to address any of your more specific questions that I may not be able to handle.
Questions for Ms. Cooper Richardson or Ms. Poe? Thank you very much.
Important
bill to bring forward. Ms. Poe, come on up.
And Amanda's not here.
She said to apologize, but she had a 9:15 hearing.
No problem.
She had to leave, and she has written testimony.
You know,
and in a sense, I could testify on her behalf also.
Just go for it.
Okay.
We're all good.
Good morning. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. My name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice up in Beaverton, and I have submitted written testimony and give some of my background, but essentially my practice is focused on family formation law and has been for more than 25 years at this point. Adoption first and now family formation law, because medical technology has brought us into a whole different world of how people become parents of children today. I often joke and say it used to take two to make a baby, and now if you look at how many different ways a child can come into being, there are at least 16 ways. And it encompasses also a variety of people who can be parents today, and that includes what we would consider a traditional family of a husband and a wife. It can be single parents, it can be same-sex parents of either gender. It can be a transgendered person. So we look at what we have in Oregon law, and what we've traditionally had is a statute that dealt with paternity. So while this bill talks about modifying our paternity and parentage law, we're modifying it, but we're also trying to modernize it and bring it into today's world with the medical technology that we have and the ability to become parents. I would really love to see this bill pass. I worked on it with Basic Rights Oregon 2 years ago, and then this year we have worked together cooperatively. I've been working with DOJ and with BRO to try to come up with a bill that we felt did accomplish what DOJ wanted to accomplish, what BRO wants to accomplish, and frankly what we need to accomplish just for the citizens of Oregon and for our children, because it's really important that children have two legal parents. And with those two legal parents who would have rights, they also have responsibilities. For 10 years, I sat as a pro tem judge in Clackamas County, and I heard family law cases. And a lot of those involved child support and whether or not a parent could legally be required to pay child support. This bill would actually correct some deficiency in our law and would allow either private individuals to go and obtain child support from the other parent or the state of Oregon to do the same. And I think that's really important for our children. In the long run, we'll save our state money versus cost our state money. And I know that one of your concerns as a committee would be financial. I would hope that you could see that in the long run, we'd be doing a benefit here and we would be not costing the state money. How a person becomes a legal parent, I believe, needs to be clarified in Oregon law. Right now, it's kind of piecemeal. So we have that paternity statute, but you go, how does a woman become legally a parent? And right now, there are only three ways. She either gives birth, because we have a vital record statute that says the woman who gives birth is named as the mother. She could adopt. Adoption can be costly. It can take time and sometimes require a consent that may or may not be there. Or I created a process about 10 and a half years ago using our declaratory judgment statute to create legal parentage. Department of Justice now uses that to create parentage in some cases also. So we are also trying to bring equal protection to how people can become parents. So it's not so paternalistically focused, not just on men, but also on every parent. And I think that's important for us to do so we can avoid any equal protection challenges in the courts, which would cost all of us money and time. We had to carefully review our changes to this bill. We didn't just do a search and replace and go, oh, we're going to ungender our parentage statutes. We're going to just say parentage where it says paternity. We actually had to go through and review all of the different statutes that are contained in this very lengthy bill. And that's why it's lengthy, because we had to do that. And in some places, as pointed out by Ms. Cooper-Richardson, we left paternity there. And so I would ask you that when you have a work session on this bill, that you know that we did do that already. We carefully considered where we still needed to address the issue of biological paternity. But then there are times when we can simply say parentage. And it works. And we all worked together to do this. It wasn't just one group or another doing that. It was a very collaborative project. Basic Rights Oregon filed some testimony, and Ms. Hess asked that I just ask you to accept her testimony also. They support the bill fully. I'm one of the attorneys that they've worked with. Some of my colleagues, Beth Wolfsong, has also worked on this bill. And we would encourage that you support this bill in your work session, and also that you support it on the floor of both your houses. Thank you.
Thank you. I will just say Ms. Pope is one of my constituents. I've had conversations with her about this and other issues, which I appreciate. And this would have been extraordinarily helpful to another one of my constituents some years back, as I think all of you know, because you've been trying to be helpful to her. But I think we're out of luck at this point, given her circumstances. And if this had been in place 5 years ago, my constituent and her children would not be in the position that they're in right now. So I appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this, and I look forward to supporting this. Are there other questions for Ms. Pope?
Okay. Thank you for your
time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time to come down and testimony. We really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, in context, there is a fiscal impact out there from Oregon Health Authority, and I think that primarily revolves around expectations around having to update systems based on this bill. That's probably an area for further discussion that may not be an expected requirement, which would mitigate the fiscal, but we need to have some clarification on what the expectations are around forms and systems and other places where we capture maybe the word father where it may not be relevant going forward. And I don't know if there are, that conversation had been had or not.
We have had those conversations, but I don't know if DOJ wants to express anything about that. But we have talked about it and realized that obviously the statutes will have to be updated. There are some forms, but from my perspective, what I work on, some of those forms are actually contained in the statutes. So the language just has to be changed there. But I believe that the fiscal impact is fairly modest on that, and it would be a one-time impact.
Well, and I also don't know. It seems like there may be other systems or programs or forms that maybe weren't really aware of the bill that may be touched at some point. That, again, I don't know if the statutes only affect Oregon Health Authority. My guess is probably not really in terms of addressing.
Well, in theory, it would go into something like one eligibility because then, but that's being created de novo now, so we should just put this on their radar for the team that's working on that to make sure that the fields are parent one, parent two, as opposed to anything else.
And I do a lot of work with vital records because I am constantly asking them to amend birth certificates and create new ones, seriously, constantly. And they already do that. So the form that we have to file with the court that then goes to vital records already says like parent one, parent two, adoptive mother, adoptive father. I think there are three choices under each one. Natural parent, adoptive parent, and parent one or parent two. And then when birth certificates come, there typically either isn't a designation. There are two forms of birth certificates that we get, a short form and a long form. And the long form would say parent or parent. It doesn't differentiate at this point. So I think we're good there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ms.
I appreciate
Burnham.
The time.
Thank you, Ms. Pope. Really appreciate your time and your work on this. It's very important. Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Ms. Byerly? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 512. Ms. Byerly, you want to update the committee on what our plans are for the rest of the week?
As of right now, there are no meetings scheduled for the rest of the week, but I expect that will change, possibly on short notice, so stay tuned.
Yeah, this is the time of year, for those of you who have not been on Ways and Means before, to be aware that your life can change in literally an hour, because we're on one-hour posting. So pretty much everything we're likely to be hearing at this point, we have heard before or has been heard before, so it qualifies for one-hour posting. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, the posting, like, I understand why we posted last week, because we wanted to move that out. We were waiting for the amendment. Generally, should we be, I mean, I just assume that we're going to have a meeting every day at 8:30. Will they generally be slotted then, or might it
generally,
be 2 o'clock or 9 o'clock? Or
but I would
watch.
We will LFO does a really good job letting your staff know. So when you go back to the office today, I would warn your staff that life may get complicated over the next few weeks, because this committee will probably keep running pretty close to the end of the month, I would say. Maybe even into early July, depending. So, I know, don't look at me like that, Representative Hayden. I'm just saying. So, that's where we are.
We're still planning to meet on the 4th, right?
We're still planning to meet on the 4th, for sure. Our own parade, right here in Hearing Room F. Okay, without further ado, I'm closing the meeting.
We're adjourned.
All right.
Have you two for 10 minutes?